ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 1 चैप्टर 12 टेक्स्ट 28 ट्रांसलेशन एंड कमेंट्री बाय हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस एसी भक्तिवेदांत स्वयं प्रभुपाद। जिज्ञासितात्मयाथार्थ्यो मुनिर्व्याससुतादसौ हिद्वेदं नृपगङ्गायां यास्यत्याधाकुतो भयम्। रेफरिंग टू महाराज परीक्षित, the statement is, after inquiring about proper self-knowledge from the son of Vyasadeva, who will be a great philosopher, he will renounce all material attachment and achieve a life of fearlessness. Purport: material knowledge means ignorance of the knowledge of one's own self. Philosophy means to seek after the right knowledge of one's own self, or the knowledge of self-realization. Without self-realization, philosophy or dry speculation or a waste of time and energy. Srimad Bhagavatam gives the right knowledge of one's own self, and by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam one can get free from material attachment and enter into the kingdom of fearlessness. This should actually be given just when you sit down, not in the middle of the class. It's a disturbance in the middle of the class. The hearing is more important than the garland. This material world is fearfulness. Its prisoners are always fearful, as within a prison house. In the prison house, no one can violate the jail rules and regulations, and violating the rules means another term for extension of prison life. Similarly, we in this material existence are always fearful. This fearfulness is called anxiety. Everyone in the material life, in all species and varieties of life, is full of anxieties, either by breaking or without breaking the laws of nature. Liberation or mukti means relief from these constant anxieties. This is possible only when the anxiety is changed to the devotional service of the Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam gives us the chance to change the quality of anxiety from matter to spirit. This is done in the association of a learned philosopher like the self-realized Shukadev Goswami, the great son of Sri Vyasadeva. Maharaj Parikshit, after receiving warning of his death, took advantage of this opportunity by associating with Shukadev Goswami and achieving the desired result. There is a sort of imitation of this reciting and hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam by professional men, and their foolish audience thinks that they will get free from the clutches of material attachment and attain the life of fearlessness. Such imitative hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam is a caricature only. Do you all know what that means, caricature? It could be that. It means something like a drama or a show. It's a show, but the real thing is not there. Such imitating of Srimad Bhagavatam is a caricature only, and one should not be misled by such a performance of Bhagavatam Saptaha, undertaken by ridiculous, greedy fellows to maintain an establishment of material enjoyment. Srila Prabhupada writes here, philosophy means to seek after the right knowledge of one's own self, or the knowledge of self-realization. Philosophy, both within the Vedic context and in other contexts, which means, in the modern world, Western philosophy is prominent, if at all there's any philosophy. Well, there is some, I can't say there's no philosophy. And there must be others also which we don't hear about, Chinese philosophy. which they've Chinese, and then there'll be Japanese, and it may be different approaches altogether in their whole approach to philosophy. In China's Confucianism, they wouldn't so much be called or considered philosophy in the sense that philosophy is considered in the Western world, but it's more like codes of living. But philosophy, within the Vedic context or the non-Vedic context, extends to many spheres apart from that of self-realization. For example, philosophy of law, underlying law, philosophy of ethics, philosophy of science, philosophy of history, can be applied to all different branches, but that is there within the Vedic context, but it's not so much departmentalized. Srila Prabhupada sometimes used the term departmental knowledge, in which he referred to, by that he referred to secular topics such as history, geography, and so on. And he distinguished that from real knowledge, knowledge of the self and of self-realization. So he used this term to establish or to make the point that what in the modern world is considered education is not really education. People are not really knowledgeable. He called that departmental knowledge, but the essence of all knowledge is self-realization, and that. So even within the Vedic context, there may be philosophy applied to law, for instance. But it's all based on the. It's all very strongly centered in the understanding that human life is meant for self-realization. Now, it's not necessarily that everyone in the Vedic culture agrees with that, because there are also, for instance, Mimamsakas who are not at all interested in self-realization as it's conceived of by the Vedantists or others within Vedic culture. They're materialists. There is a very great difference between philosophy in the modern Western context and Vedic philosophy, is in as much as lack of any fixed basis. Vedic philosophy is based in Vedas. And modern Western philosophy is based on, as Srila Prabhupada writes here, without self-realization, philosophy is dry speculation or a waste of time and energy. So that's a good description of Western philosophy. And can also apply to Vedic philosophy, or that which is superficially Vedic, because, like the Mimamsakas, they're not interested in self-realization. They have some kind of philosophy, but it's not based on self-realization. I've been watching in the last few months some videos of debates between atheists and theists. The theists have been Christians. This is in the Western world. And a waste of time and energy is a very good description of such debates. neither of them have, from neither side do they first of all establish what their epistemology is. According to Christianity, their epistemology is supposed to be what they understand from the Bible, but that's also largely speculative, and the Bible really doesn't give very little philosophy or very little knowledge, except if you can call it knowledge, or if it's accurate, accounts of the Jewish people and their interactions with their tribal God. And then there are descriptions of Jesus, which may or may not be accurate, as they were written some years after his some years after he's ceased ministering in Palestine. But there's no clear philosophical system in, or hardly any philosophy at all, in the Bible, and whatever philosophy is there in modern Christianity, it's been extrapolated largely from the ancient Greeks, who are not Christians or anything like Christians. And over the years, it's been added on modern humanistic or atheistic philosophy. It's become the morals of modern Christianity are, although they claim that it comes from the Bible, a lot of it comes from modern humanism. So it's really a bunch of speculation. And they're discussing, the atheists and the theists are discussing, one of the common topics is, what is good for the world? Is Christianity good for the Christians? Say Christianity is good for the world. And the atheists say, no, it's bad for the world. They don't only say it's not good, but it's actually bad for the world. They both seem to have the same idea of what good for the world means. That means people live peacefully and happily in this world and enjoy a life of not very gross sense gratification. And they all cooperate with each other and live happily in a life of sense gratification. So they're both extremely shallow. The Christians, they don't question the epistemology of the atheists, and many of them agree with it to a large extent. Of course, there are also the evangelical type of Christians, but the atheists, they don't debate with them, because you can't debate. They're non-debatable with, because they're fanatics, and they believe implicitly in what they understand, their interpretation of the Bible. But then, if we say that, well, our philosophy is rooted in the Vedas and theirs is rooted in the Bible, but it's not on the same level. Because, yeah, the Bible is anyway, the Old Testament is a bunch of tribal, the tribes of, they call it the tribes of Israel. It's their tribal history. And what constitutes the Bible anyway is, there's the Old Testament and the New Testament, which consists of the life of Jesus, stories handed down verbally before they were written down, and then there are the writings of Paul, who his teachings are quite different to those of Jesus. And then you got the book of Revelations, which I remember reading that as a kid, and at the time I thought that whoever wrote it must have been on LSD. it, And that's taken as practically the most important book by evangelical Christians, and it's just wild. All this stuff about the beast, and it's and what constitutes the Bible? It was written, the New Testament was written in Greek, which was not a language that Jesus spoke, or was even or anyone spoke in the area that Jesus ministered in. And then it was translated to Latin, and Latin to English, and then again it's been changed. Some editions of the Bible have God as he or she, because they don't believe that God can be a he. Could as well be a she, probably more likely to be a she. It's got nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus or any of the biblical prophets, who are called the patriarchs, which is a term which feminists use to insult who they see as male chauvinistic pigs. But in other words, it doesn't have a very solid basis, and as far as philosophy is concerned, there's nothing to be. They had to, the Christians, when they at some point in time they realized they needed to have some philosophy. That happened a few hundred years. It took them a few hundred years to realize that. Then, because the Bible doesn't offer anything even approaching anything which could be built on for philosophy, they had to borrow it from. They took it from other sources. So the Vedic corpus is quite different. It's apaurusheya. It's not written down by, and it's not given by anyone. It doesn't. In one sense, the source is Narayan, because Narayan is the source of everything, but on the other hand, it's eternal, and it coexists with Narayan, just as knowledge and the object of knowledge, they coexist intrinsically. Just for instance, this is a watch strap. So the fact that it's made of some kind of plastic, that is a knowledge which is intrinsically related with that watch, and it exists in one sense independently. It's not the knowledge that it's made of plastic is not the substance of the watch, so it's something different, but it coexists intrinsically. Knowledge and the object of knowledge coexist. So the Vedas, they are knowledge of reality, and they coexist with reality. And they're eternal, because reality is eternal. So it is a completely different approach. Of course, the Vedas, parts of them are revealed at certain times. The Vedas are originally revealed to Brahma, in each universe, and then they get handed down, and then there are Krishna himself sometimes comes and he comes again and again as avatars and speaks the knowledge of the Vedas, which tends to get lost in this world. Parts of the Vedas are revealed from time to time through rishis who channel the mantras of the Vedas. Taittiriya Upanishad, that came up when the Yajnavalkya, he decided that he wasn't satisfied with his guru, and he went directly to the source and got some mantras, and then on the order of his guru he vomited them up, and his other disciples, they took the form of partridges and ate those. It's quite an unusual story, but that's how the Taittiriya Upanishad, which has a very important revelations about the nature of the absolute reality. There's the first principle of what is the absolute reality. Janmadyasya yataha, that statement. The ultimate reality is that which is the source, that from which, that from which everything emanates, that in which everything exists, and that into which everything again enters. So that the first two sutras of the Brahma Sutras, Atato Brahma Jignasa, Janmadyasya Yataha, now we should inquire into Brahman. So those two sutras are a summary of lines from Taittiriya Upanishad, this Yatova Imani Bhutani Jayante Yena Yena Jatani Jivanti Yat Prayanta Bisang Vishanti Tad Vijikasasva Tad Brahmeti, which says thus, that from which everything emanates, that in which everything exists, that in which everything again enters, that is the proper subject of inquiry, that is Brahman. So, Vedic corpus, Vedic philosophy. Yesterday we were talking about material attachments, how one has to be free of material attachments to become Krishna conscious, to understand God. And this is a major point of Vedic understanding, both for Mayavadis and for devotees. But it does exist there to some extent in some branches of Christianity which are practically non-existent at the present time, or rather among some individuals who might be called mystics, but there's no clear idea of any such thing in Christianity. You have to get free from material attachments. Rather, they take God to be someone who fulfills their material desires, and people stop believing in God when he doesn't fulfill their material desires. So it's a very primitive. Islam, they also have their rishi to whom their scripture was revealed. And Muhammad, when he was challenged, how can you say you're getting it from God? Why should we believe you? That was an intelligent protest or question. He said, "Well, see if you can compose anything that's anything on the same level. This is coming from God. No man can compose works of such profundity as this." Well, if we take that as the standard of the Quran being given by God, well, compare it with the Vedic knowledge and you'll find lots which is much better. So if that's the proof that you give for the Quran coming from God, then you should accept that the Vedic knowledge is also coming from God, is a much better revelation. But they're all meatheads, and what can they understand? So philosophically we have very good basis here. I've been going through these books, The India They Saw, and visitors to India, the visitors to India who give the historical knowledge which is accepted as bona fide by mundane scholars, the earliest such people were Chinese visitors who came with the specific purpose of gaining knowledge of Buddhism. Which Buddhism, anyway, the Buddha, he hardly taught anything anyway. He gave very little directions. And the whole Buddhist philosophy and cosmology and attitude to life and everything, it was all derived from the Vedic knowledge and Vedic culture anyway. It's just they changed a few words and rejected the Vedas. They redefined a few words, and it's practically the Vedic culture, except that they they reject the Vedas, but all the concepts they have come from the Vedas. So the Chinese came to the land of philosophy, and even the Arabs, who are the, they might have been more philosophical, some of them at that time, than they are now. I mean, that's maybe true of everyone all over the world, including in India. You can hardly imagine that this place was a land of philosophy. You see, I mean, even in the West, you find a lot of people are more philosophical than in India, and even though they don't have anything really very philosophical to go on. But and the spread of Sai Babaism is a sure sign that whatever philosophy might have trickled down to the people in the past, there's no such thing going on now. But the Arabs who made journals of their visits, and they were astounded by things like rhinoceri and banyan trees and things like this. They often refer to India as being a land of philosophers. And the Greeks, of course, yeah. The Greeks were even before the Chinese, and they also, they're very impressed by the philosophers. I just ate broad beans 2 days ago, and I read that the Indian people, they don't eat it because, being a land of philosophers, they think it destroys the intellect. So, I never heard of that before. I regularly used to eat it in Bengal. Of course, what they mean by broad beans might not be exactly the same thing it's pretty much the same thing that's called broad beans in England. So, what happened to the land of philosophers? It was until recently, up to the time Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, in every village, there were people who had philosophers, and you can understand from the tone of his discourse that some people understood him. He was speaking. He influenced people to follow him, and he discussed with people, which means they could understand him. Whereas nowadays, hardly anyone can understand what his language is. So that culture was there. The old culture coming down generation after generation, verbally handed down the knowledge of the Vedas, or the Vedas, verbally handed down, not written down. So that actually makes the memory very strong and the intelligence very strong. If children are taught in youth, from a very early age, learning shlokas by memorizing. The modern idea of education is this: memorizing is useless waste of time, and you just have to bring out the innate tendencies. But then you get America something like number 26 in the world in terms of their education, the educational level of their population. So they have a lot of intelligent people there, but most of them are imported from countries like India, where they never incorporated all these fancy new ideas about education. So, that educational culture and philosophical culture was very strong. But then they incorporated Western education, which its express purpose is for producing competent shudras. The people, they can do science and make machines. And this atheism is coming up in the Western world, and in India also. It's on the basis of the assumption that, well, by science we're understanding everything, but science... modern science is—it's not philosophical. It's a shudra way of looking at the world, without any philosophical content or any higher understanding beyond matter. So it will spread because it appeals to the dull mentality of Shudras. When we say Shudra, often in India we have to qualify that because people think of some caste. But when we're talking about Shudras, we're not talking about people by birth, but we're talking about the mentality of people who are not fit for understanding higher subject matter. Which is to break that misunderstanding, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave brahminical initiation to people who are not born in that caste, if they actually showed the symptoms of being brahminical, according to the teachings of Gita. Krishna says, Chaturvarnyam Mayashrishtam Guna Karma Vibhagasha. That the four divisions of society, according to the qualities and the type of work that someone takes up, not the not by birth. Yasya yal lakshanam proktam punso vana abhivyanjakam. What is that? Drishyeta. What's the next line? Anjakam hai. Yasya yal lakshanam proktam punso vana abhivyanjakam. What's the next line? Can you look that up? Yasya yal tadrishyeta. Yasya yal are the first two words. Yasya is a common word. Yal is Y-A-L. It's a modified form of yat, because it comes before lakshanam. Yad anra trapi drishyeta tat teneva vinirdishet. Yes, Narada Muni, when he's speaking on the four divisions of, well, the eight divisions, four plus four, of human society, he says that wherever all these characteristics which I've spoken, yasya yal lakshanam proktam punso vana vivyanjakam, by which the people are understood to be of a certain varna, tenaiva, what is it? Tatvinir desha drishyeta. It's a long time since I quoted that verse. Yad anyat trapi, if such symptoms are seen in others also, yad anyat trapi drishyeta, tattenaiva vinirdishet, they should be understood to be according to that varna. So in other words, from this we can understand that, yes, generally by birth, but not specific, not in a fixed way. If those, by birth, it may be generally by birth, but not fixedly. Okay, any questions? Yasya yal lakshanam proktam pungso vana vivyanjakam yadanya trapi drishyeta tat tenaiva vinirdishet. Srila Prabhupada quoted that quite often. But birth is also a factor, because one does, one is placed in a certain womb, karmana deva netrena jantra deho papatya, under the guidance of the Supreme Lord and his representatives, one is placed in an appropriate in position, and also we find in Gita, Krishna says, he speaks about the Daivi Sampat and the Asuri Sampat, the which in this context means, Sampat generally means wealth, but in this case means the nature or characteristics of a Deva or an Asura. So they are, one is born with them, Krishna says. They're just like a Dambo Darpo Bhimanas Chakroda Parisham Evacha. Agyana Parisham Evacha. Oh, what's wrong with me? I can't remember my verses at all these days. Ah, last few days, especially. Parisham Evacha. Agyana Chabijatasya. Partha Sampadam Asurim. Chabijatasya. These bad qualities are born with the asuras. People of demoniac outlook, they are pride, arrogance, egoism, anger, harshness, ignorance. These are born. They're inborn of persons of the asura, and similarly the persons of godly qualities that sattva sankshuddhi jnana yoga vyavastitihi. So they're inborn. Of course, that could also be taken to mean that such qualities are born out of the nature. It could also be interpreted like that. Yeah, none? Abhayam sattva sankshuddhi jnana yoga vyavastitihi dana tamascha yajnasya svadhyaya stava arjavam. Yeah.
What is the studying of, what is the use of studying so many Vedic literature, what is the use of explaining them in different ways, and no need to study any more Vedic literature, nor does anyone need to describe them by philosophical speculation. Then he quotes Bhagavad Gita that then one understands the Supreme Personality of Godhead by executing devotional service.
Yeah, what is the use of studying Vedic literature? That quotation within Prabhupada's book should be taken within the context of all the rest of his books. That's certainly true on one level of Krishna consciousness. Just like for the gopis, they don't discuss Vedic knowledge, hardly, and philosophy. So at that level, certainly it's true. But if it was universally true, then what Srila Prabhupada was doing at every moment of his life, practically discussing Vedic philosophy, he would nullify it. So it has to be understood contextually, not take it out of context. The example of Karna. Yeah, by birth. He was refused. That was a good way to refuse him, if you didn't want him. And Karna was refused to partake in the Swayamvar of Draupadi because he wasn't from the right caste. And that was also true, that was also applicable according to the social system at that time, which was based on that, whether rightly or wrongly. Up until recently, there were very distinct divisions of class in Europe. At least when I was growing up, it was still called upper class, middle class, and working class, and they still have such terms. And there's this, there's a famous musical, it's made as a movie, My Fair Lady, which was based on some upper class man saw some beautiful girl in London who was from a very low class background, and he trained her to become upper class, so that no one thought that she was from such a low class background. I can't remember the whole thing, but the whole idea is that you're born in a certain class and that's where you stay. And that broke down with the French Revolution and the whole process of breaking it down, so that everyone's lowest than lower class. it's all equal now. But even now, just like the in the English royal family, they don't, you know, they got to marry someone with a little class. They can't marry some, you know, well, the standard thing in England is the fish selling woman that's considered the bottom of the pits. You have to marry someone who can speak with the kind of accent that would be considered acceptable in Oxford or Cambridge or on the BBC. The BBC is also becoming democratic by having people with regional accents narrate documentaries and so forth for them. So just making the point here that the idea of classes, and Americans are fascinated by eugenics. Yeah, the royals only marry royals. They stopped that now. The British royals, there are hardly any royals left to marry. There are only a few royal families left in Europe. And most of the royal families, they're just, they're not really very royal. Like the king of Norway will cycle around in the streets, which, yeah, kings don't do things like that, but there's modern kings. Yeah. Well, in England, they keep up a semblance of kingship. America, yeah, they're fascinated by royalty and all this kind of thing. If they ever kick out the kings in England, they could maybe get a job over in America. Why don't you have a king? They kicked out the king years ago. 250 years, something like that. Anyway, this is getting a little mundane here, this discussion. So, let's finish it there.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Maybe you read also this Rotemar, this article on the Vedic roots of Western religious tradition.
I probably have, but I don't remember it now, reading such a thing.
It actually, the dualism, how it was
interesting. Oh, this Zoroastrianism and the. Of course, that's not original research by him, but he's put it together in a certain way. The whole idea of the devil and the battle between good and evil, this all came from Zoroastrianism, which was a upper sampradaya of Vedic knowledge. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about this using as a preaching tool? I mean, when we preach to people, is it?
Could you use it for preaching? I'd keep it up your sleeve, as they say. If appropriate, you could use it, but only. You could talk about Christianity and how this whole, all these ideas became adopted from. Much of the ideas of Christianity are adopted from non-Christian sources. One thing I think these atheists are doing a very good job of in the West is showing how bogus Christianity is. It doesn't really affect the question of whether God exists or not. But they do make a good case that the conception of God in, or concept would be a better term, concept is more vague than conception. The concept of God in Christianity is... Well, the whole of Christianity is just such a philosophically, it's such a mess. It's and so they're making a good job of that. The thing I wanted to bring to their attention is that you, both of you, the theists and the atheists, you're both missing a major aspect of reality. You're both completely overlooking it, which that should be brought into the discussion, the phenomenon of reincarnation, which is very good. There's very good evidence at least as good as that for, at least as acceptable as that of evolution, of reincarnation. I mean, if you accept that there are a little bone here, a little bone there a bone, there a bone, everywhere a bone, bone, and you dig up a bone here, you dig up a bone there, and make some geological speculations about how old they are and which rock formation they came in, and neglect all these neglect all the evidence of civilized human life millions of years ago, to finding perfectly formed golden bowls in rock strata deep in the earth, which is like 300 million years old, and things like that. So at least the investigations, scientific investigations into reincarnation, are at least as plausible as those of evolution, and you're just ignoring it. So that's a major factor. It doesn't establish the existence of God, but it's a major factor which is just overlooked in the Western world, both by theists and atheists. And the atheists can pick it up and become Buddhists also, or Mimamsakas also. But it changes the discussion. And why is it being ignored? Just because of your bias, that's all. Your bias to not accept it. Bias in Sanskrit would be apekshita, I guess. Taking aside. So you have the word near a picture.
Although there are some Christians.
There are some Christians who believe in reincarnation. I don't know how they can. It's a very different. Reincarnation, as I understand it, can be incorporated into Christianity if you chuck out the standard Christian dogma that Jesus came to deliver us for all of our sins by dying on the cross, and just take Christ at face value and see what he said and what he taught. Then you don't have Christianity, because Christ didn't really start a religion based on himself. Or maybe he did. There are some things said about Jesus, about my kingdom is, you know, it seems, from what's written about Jesus, it seems like he was on a bit of a trip about being the king and all this kind of thing. But otherwise his teachings were well, of course, many people say he was influenced by Buddhism. There's that blank spot from the age of 12 to 30, and which he's said to have gone to India, which was not only, and India was never all Buddhist. The Vedic religion existed in a corrupt form side by side, but they both accept reincarnation. So. I don't see how reincarnation can be harmonized with standard Christianity, that you have one life, and then you're either a Christian and you believe in Jesus and you get saved. There's a day of judgment, and then Jesus comes back and he picks up a few people and chucks the rest in hell forever, and that's it. Just one blip in time called the creation of the. And that's it, it's all over.
But there are statements in the Bible which are clearly indicated.
Yeah, there are statements in the Bible which, yeah, but what I'm saying that it doesn't. What I'm saying is that as you sow, so you shall reap is. It doesn't necessarily point to reincarnation, but it can be.
There is that about lying.
Oh, there is John the Baptist, is he Elijah, and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, from the Bible you could deduce it, but it doesn't fit with this standard understanding of Christianity. Of it's a one-time round, and it's a Russian roulette, because the Muslims say you have to believe in Islam, and the Christians say you have to believe in Christianity, and then they have so many subdivisions, and the Shias, they don't want to be in paradise with the Sunnis, and vice versa. They want them all to go to hell. So you'll find someone's in the United Reformed Episcopal Pentecostal Baptist Church of the 1922 Revision B, and only we, all seven members of our church, are saved because we have the beliefs exactly right. It's a mess. It's a mess. And in fact, why Christianity is given so much importance? It's a tribal religion which somehow or other got adopted in the Western world, and then it was. And the Western world has been in a big mess ever since. It was a political tool. It was adopted as a political tool. So it's really a real step backwards for the Western world. And then the Western world became prominent. One reason they became prominent, as I understand it, is because of Christianity. Because it had this idea of, within Christianity, there's the idea, and Islam also, they have the idea of conquering for Jesus or conquering for Islam. Whereas in Vedic culture, the whole idea of invading other countries and occupying them and exploiting them, it's not there. Kings would attack other kings, but we see in the case of Duryodhana the desire to own the throne simply for being so that I can be the king, not for the sake of dharma but for the sake of self-aggrandizement. That's considered demoniac, and we don't find that in the Indian mentality even today. Just like they smashed Pakistan three times in wars, and they could have annexed it. They should have done the first time when people were still not really used to being Pakistan, but they didn't do that. Pakistan attacked, and India rebutted them, and then they just left it at that. They didn't take it over or even try to control it in any way, which is probably a mistake considering political realities. But it's just not part of the mentality to attack and pillage and rape and exploit and dominate in that way. The king may dominate other kings, but for the sake of dharma. If it's considered better for the people to be under a stronger king than a weaker king. And only the kshatriyas fight. The fighting will be going on in one field, and in the next field the farmer will be ploughing his fields, and he doesn't care who wins. It doesn't make any difference to him. And from outside they were able to conquer. One reason is because of Buddhism, I see, because the idea the kings were there, but they wouldn't fight. Whoever had the strongest army, if one was going to invade, they'd just submit. And they were against the principle of fighting. And then another reason is because the Indian Kshatriyas, of course there was discord between the Rajputs themselves and this and that. That's also a fact. That's usually played up as the major factor. And they talk about the Islamic warriors' military superiority. But as I understand it, the Indian kings, the Hindu kings, as we nowadays call them, they were militarily very competent and very powerful, but they had certain rules that they played to, and they just couldn't imagine doing things like the Muslims did, like coming from behind and attacking by surprise, night raids and all this kind of thing. They had principles. You've two armies face each other and they fight. You don't come behind someone and shoot them all and things like that. So that I think is also a major reason for the reason that they were able to be overcome. They say superior military tactics, but it's subhuman, low class. Yeah.
It seems that up till Jesus, there are most of the people are actually worshipping demigods
all over the world. With every the demigod worshippers, yeah.
Until 6th century or 7th century, when Muhammad appeared, he was coming from tribe, his Quraysh, they were worshipping some three demigods.
Yeah, demigod worship, polytheism was
the... these were only Jews, there were some Jews, and there were some Christians, Christian sects which were chased out from the Byzantine, like Nestorians and Gnostics.
They're also polytheistic.
Well, they were strange, they were their own.
Christianity and Islam and some Jews were monotheistic. Generally, Judaism is considered monotheistic, or if you want to call it monotheistic, because their God is also a mental construct, largely. It's impersonal. But Vaishnavism is clearly monotheistic, but it's qualified monotheism, you could say, with different. But it is, if any neutral study from any Western university cares to study it, they'll find it is clearly monotheistic. And that also goes for certain Shaiva schools. But it's much more nuanced. It's difficult to... Because Western theism is so simplistic that it's difficult to put the Vedic culture into their boxes. So Vaishnavism is monotheistic, but they might say in some ways it's polytheistic, because there are different forms of God, and many of the Vaishnav schools are mixed up with Mayavad also, where it's much more nuanced.
It seems that this Christianity and especially Islam, they're like a result revolt towards this demigod worship.
Against demigod worship. Christianity and Islam especially was a revolt against demigod worship.
Yeah, because they were, although they have also, and later on, like in Christianity, they have everyone had in
there. Yeah, and Catholicism is, it's practically demigod worship. There's some survey they made of Catholics. They say, if you're in trouble, who do you pray to? And Jesus was about number 7. Mary was number 1, and then there were other saints. But Protestants, they emphasize Jesus. So, actually when I was talking about Christianity, in a very broad way during that lecture, I mean, I wasn't so much addressing Lutheranism, which is another take, the rhythmicism of Christianity. That's another take on the whole thing. Okay, should we finish that? Oh, just one thing. You were saying about Islam. You're saying it's a revolt against demigods. From what I understand, and I haven't studied it deeply, it seems to me that Islam arose, and one of the major factors in that was the personal interest and ambition of certain gentlemen who's called Hazrat Muhammad. Yeah, it was very mixed up with his own personal ambitions also.
He was from the demigod worship. He was from the tribe worshiping them. So he said that he hates them most, this demigod.
So his own personal interest was well served also. You can't say anything to any Muslim, actually. You know, all you can do is submit.
No discussion.
No discussion. No.
Like this guy, Holland, he killed 2004.
Yeah.
He butchered him and he left a message. Whoever, this message is for everyone.
Anyone speaks against Islam, you get killed. That in 2004, was it, in Holland? And this Salman Rushdie, his whole life he has to live in hiding. I don't know, and probably most Muslims don't know what his actual crime is, but he's supposed to have spoken against Islam. Well, I doubt if anyone knows, hardly anyone's read his book.
Danish cartoon,
yeah. Dangerous, dangerous bunch of people. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Hare Krishna.